Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to MidRap, where the Navy Mil Blog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those of us who are joining us live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page and join our chat room with the usual suspects. As is our usual want, if you have questions or observations about what you hear between us and our guest, feel free to share them there. And if you have some questions that you want to put in, Eagle One will ride herd on the gaggle and will take some of the good questions there and just kind of fold those into our conversation. And for those of you that are new to MidRats, if you would like to catch up on the shows that you missed, you can always reach the archives at Blog Talk Radio, or you can set yourself up to get the podcast automatically up on iTunes. Enough of the pre-stuff. Let's get on with the show. We've got two subjects today that we want to cover, but they really interplay a lot, and they cover the spectrum from Northeast to Southwest Asia. Our first guest will be Seth Crosby. He is the senior fellow from the Hudson Institute. He'll be on to discuss China and in general influence that they have over Asia and globally. And second, we're going to pivot just a little bit to the Southwest. We're going to have Bill Roggio on from Long Wars Journal with a focus of the conversation on Pakistan in this decade and some of the challenges we continue to have with that country. But let's roll into our first guest. He is going to be Seth Crosby. He began his career in government at the Defense Department as the assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger, and subsequently served as Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy in the Reagan and Bush administrations, where he is responsible for the Navy's position on efforts to reorganize DOD, develop the maritime strategy, the Navy's academic institutions, naval special operations, and burden sharing with our NATO allies. In the Bush administration, he moved on to OSD to become Acting Assistant Secretary and then Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low-Intensity Conflict. During the period that came right before the collapse of the USSR from about 82 to 84, he directed the editorial policy of the Voice of America on the Solidarity movements in Poland, E-40. Hope you're in the audience today. That's right up your alley. Also, the Soviet treatment of dissidents and other issues. Returning to public diplomacy in 2002 as a director for the U.S. government's International Broadcasting Bureau, he supervised the agency's successful efforts to make sure they were undertaken in the direction of radio and telegraph television broadcasting to the Muslim world. His work in the private sector includes reporting for Fortune magazine as a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the director of the Heritage Foundation's Asia Studies from 91 to 94. If you like what you hear today, you can go back in the archives. You can find a link to his personal site and archives and some recent work of his over at my homepage, but you can also find him in commentary, foreign affairs, the public interest, the national interest, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Washington Times, and a few other national journals. Seth, welcome to MidRats.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You're welcome. A man of much experience requires at least a little bit of an intro there, but that's okay. When I was reading your bio and your background, the one thing that popped into my mind that I wanted to kind of roll your way, especially for those of us that have been around for a while, is your experience in our, lack of a better phrase, strategic communications and how we tried to communicate with the people in the Eastern Bloc, the what was then the Warsaw Pact. And here we find ourselves in 2010. We still have a big, officially called a communist country in China, but it's Chinese, it's different. And the way we see them nowadays isn't so much communist as a mercantilist country. How do you see that we can communicate with the Chinese people using some of the lessons we had from the Cold War or can we really take anything and we just have to really customize our message to them?
Well, it's a good question. There are many ways of communicating with a large, huge country like China. One of them is diplomatic. So our diplomats talk with their diplomats. And our foreign policy supposedly, ought to have some objectives, and diplomacy follows them. One of the others is public diplomacy. And that means what we do on radio and television and internet and Twitter and large means of communications that the U.S. government has to speak directly to populations of other countries. The other is our national security policy, what kinds of signals we send by our presence in the region or lack of it, what kind of policy we maintain towards our allies in the region or lack of it. So you put all of these things together and one hopes you have a coherent, some coherent objectives, some goals that are being followed in a purposeful way. In this case, that I think it's reasonable to say that we want a normal, decent relationship with China and not one of hostility, although there's competition. We want to keep it at the level of economic competition and would like a secure, stable Eastern Asia, Western Pacific, but where economic competition is flourishing to the benefit of all peoples, and there's peace and stability.
Eagle One.
And there is peace and stability, and let us hope that the people of the region there ultimately enjoy the same ability to control their own fate that we do here in the United States.
Well, let me ask you about some of China's announced policies and what we're doing in response. I mean, China has indicated various times they're interested in what has been called a string of pearls, defense of the South China Sea as their part of that is their own territorial waters. They've increased their own navy, while our navy seems to be in a numbers decline. What are they up to? You got any idea?
I'm not sure they know what they're up to. Okay, so I'll preface my. You know, what I'm going to say with that. The string of pearls that you talk correctly about is not only in the South China Sea, but extends throughout the Indian Ocean, and they're interested in basing agreements that extend as far west as Africa. And the territorial issues they have are not only with countries in their immediate vicinity, relatively immediate vicinity, like the Philippines and Vietnam and Japan, but also with India, countries as far to the west as India. So, and as you know, and I think your audience know, they've established basically a naval base in Pakistan. At Qatar, and so I would not restrict their ambition simply to the waters closest to them, to the first or even the second island chain. The commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, Admiral Willard, has talked about their interest in carrier aviation. You don't do that to protect your coast. We do that to be able to project power. So I think that they're interested in power projection. That's certainly supported by their increasing visits, port visits around the world. Their CNO is going to more and more places. It's supported by what they say about denying us, the United States Navy, access to the Western Pacific. It's supported by, again, a couple of days ago, the Asahi Shimbun, a large newspaper in Tokyo, reported that Admiral Willard had said that they were, that China was close to having an operational anti-ship ballistic missile, which the Chinese would like to be able to use to target our aircraft carriers. So I think their ambitions are clearly far beyond coastal, that they would like to see a blue water navy, that they have some legitimate concerns, for example, protecting the sea lines of communication on which they depend for a huge amount of oil. And then they have some other ambitions as far as probably regional hegemony. And that's something that the United States has to be very clear about, and the signals that we send are going to determine whether they become a regional hegemon or not.
This is Sal again. In your answers to the previous question, it brought something to mind. You know, we look back 100 years ago when somebody talked about a rising power who was bringing on a relatively new naval presence globally that people weren't used to looking at. If you had a country that was looking for additional resources and was stepping its foot into Africa that had been in the domain of the other established powers, it kind of reminds me in some ways of the rise of the post-unification of Germany. And in response to that, the UK and France got together to try to balance that rise. And you also brought India in to one of the discussions that we had. Do you see a growing relationship between the U.S. and India, kind of paralleling the diplomatic front along with the power of the two being together between India and the U.S. against China, for lack of a better phrase, similar to the way that France and the U.K. tried to work together to balance a rising Germany?
Well, the similarity has yes, there are similarities, yes. And I agree with you that the United States and India have understood that they have parallel strategic interests in making sure that there is a balance in Asia. I think that was clear in the previous administration, in the Bush administration, and although I'm not entirely certain of the degree at which it's acknowledged in this administration, I think over the long term, India and the United States are headed in each other's direction. And China is a major cause for that, and there's simply no other way to say it.
Either one.
There's simply no other way to say it. We both understand what the danger of one large state being able to dictate terms in an area where, you know, a third of the world's population lives. And that's where your comparison to Germany, I think, is the most correct. England and France wanted to maintain some kind of a balance on the European continent, and they saw Germany in the opening years of the 20th century as trying to upset that balance. And, you know, the Agadir crisis, where Germany sent a warship to Morocco, certainly got Winston Churchill's attention, and he never lost it as far as Germany was concerned.
It's so funny when you.
But I think the issue was the same, and that is that far-seeing statesmen understood that German ambitions could very well upset the power balance in Europe, and they understood that that power balance was essential to a peaceful Europe. And I think we have the same problem in China today.
Yeah, I think one thing
vis-a-vis China, Asia, not Europe.
I think one thing that it didn't quite get the boost that it did, but you know, you spoke of the Morocco incident. We just recently had the unprecedented, very modest, but unprecedented little Mediterranean cruise, the Chinese Navy, that
right.
Raise eyebrow in the right places, I think. But that's a logical place for China to go to say, we're here and get used to it. Eagle One.
Right, right. Well, that is a pretty clear indication that their ambitions are not restricted to the Yellow Sea or, you know, the South China Sea, that they have a wider scope of, you know, that they're looking further than just the coastal waters. That's clear.
As they expand their Navy, it looks like they're beginning to develop aircraft carriers, which I think you note are not an indication of a coastal power anymore, but a power projection force. Is that somewhat ironic, or isn't it somewhat ironic that that's happening at the same time that they're developing the anti-aircraft carrier ballistic missiles and some of the other things? And are we sending, I guess what I'm the ultimate point I'm trying to make is, are we sending the wrong message by downsizing our Navy as they're beginning to develop their...
Absolutely. I think we're sending the wrong message, and we're compounding the sending of the wrong message by not speaking about it in direct, forthright terms, which is to say China could be a threat. We don't want to see that happen, but the strategic rationale for our Navy rests in an important way on sending a signal that we're going to remain in the Western Pacific as a force for peace as we have for 100 years. And the failure to send that signal is an encouragement to Chinese ambitions, and so I think it's not only a mistake to be reducing the size of the Navy, as it not immediately, but as it is likely to over the 20 or 30 year period, which the Chinese certainly look at, even if we don't always.
Yeah, I found it kind of a break messaging that we saw over the last month, where you saw the SecDef and a few other significant players talking about moving towards an air-sea concept of power projection. And then a few days later, you would see an article talking about we need to get ready to cut the overall defense budget. We're going to start with the Air Force and the Navy first. As this argument goes forward, you're going to have your usual parochial players. And I think that if SecDef Gates follows his projection of wanting to leave in 2011, when you look at the rest of the players in civilian outfit at the DOD, do you see a bias towards going towards that sea air concept of power projection, or the other side of the equation, which if we need to save money, we need to cut the Air Force and the Navy, because you really can't do both?
Well, I unfortunately, I don't think it's just the Defense Department that's signed on to this sort of almost exclusively continentalist way of looking at the world. I think it's the United States government as a whole. I mean, we've been at war for something like 14 of the past 21 years, and almost all of those engagements have been basically on land. Is that a matter of choice? I don't know. It's a matter of fact. And the result of that is that one result of that is that we find ourselves more and more engaged in land conflicts. And this is, after all, a maritime power, which was something that was understood by presidents from Washington until George Bush. I don't know what it was. George Bush, the father. And here we are in Afghanistan pursuing the same policies. Large and increasing engagement in a continental war on land. Yes, the Navy is contributing to it, but from Panama to the Balkans to Kuwait to Iraq to Afghanistan, we seem to be sort of, the memory hole seems to be collapsing, and the idea that our position in the world, our future as an international power, the ability to secure the seas for commerce, for safe, secure navigation, our increasing dependence upon global trade as the recession ends, which it will someday. All of these things are just sort of going away as far as American policymakers' understanding. And I think it's extremely serious for the United States, and I think it raises questions about our future as a great power.
Eagle One.
As a great power.
When you mentioned the Philippines earlier, it kind of brought home to me that a lot of the nations in Asia have depended on the United States Navy as a shield for them for the last 65 years. And is there the possibility, given what China's doing, that some of these countries, even though many of them are desperately poor by our standards, would develop their own naval forces to kind of help become the thousand-ship navy and help defend against China's encroachment on their areas?
Well, as you probably know, and many of your listeners know, the Australians have committed a couple of years ago to basically, you know, to increasing the size of their navy by a large amount. I mean, they're buying submarines, surface ships, and whatnot, and their stated reason for it is that they are concerned that who they've relied on in the past, the United States, is not going to be there in the future. And I think if you speak with naval officials, military officials, diplomats in the countries that surround China, from Japan to Korea to South Korea to the Philippines, Vietnam, Burma, that they'll all tell you the same thing privately, which is, some perhaps publicly, which is that they don't want to be lorded over by a China that can have its way.
We saw a recent.
So that's not a. That's there's nothing new there, and there's nothing surprising. But the question is, what are we going to do about it, or are we going to do anything about it? And right now, you look at this administration's national security strategy. China looks like sort of a benign partner with whom we can work out all kinds of problems and maybe even work together to solve all sorts of problems. And the idea of China as a strategic competitor simply doesn't exist. I mean, there's one mention of the military, of their military buildup, naval buildup in the entire document. And I think that's a mistake. I don't think it's a correct view of our relationship with China or the way the Chinese look at our relationship with them. And all of that sends the wrong signal.
Traditionally speaking, there's always reached a point when you're talking percentages where between two countries, when you reach a debtor and debtee relationship, that the dynamic can change. And one of the concerns is, and a lot of people will poo-poo it away. It's like, well, they won't do anything because they are so reliant on owning so much of our treasury paper. But there is a historical norm that when one nation becomes significantly indebted to another, that power relationship changes. Do the Chinese see the debtor-debtee relationship and what that should mean for when you negotiate and work on the international scale differently than we do? And if they do you see when we reach the point, if we haven't already, that dynamic between debtor and debtee starts to shift a bit?
I think they see it differently than we do. I think we see it as, they're in hoc to us so much that they don't have any choices, and so everything's fine as long as they have no interest in strategic competition with a country in which they have so much invested. If that were true, then you wouldn't see the Chinese wandering around the world looking for other places to invest their money. For example, Africa, where they can buy resources, right? You wouldn't see them making threats to other countries that need valuable minerals that the Chinese have a monopoly on. You wouldn't see their efforts to try to develop their own mineral resources as well as they possibly can for economic reasons. What you'd see them is just kind of sitting there raking in the T-bills, investing more in of their currency in American debt. But that's not what they're doing. So I think that there's a mismatch between a very different view that we have of them than they have of us.
What where does this relationship go? You've
Hello?
Talked about, made a comparison between the Venetians, who I guess you could compare to the United States, believing that they had a mercantile relationship with the Ottoman Empire, but they found out, much to their regret, I guess, that wasn't the case. Where does this U.S.-China relationship go? I mean, are we thinking this solely of commerce, and they've got something else in mind?
Right. Yeah, that's the point. I'll just say a word about it. Venice, a long time ago, had a difficult but essentially stable relationship with the Byzantine Empire that existed until the middle of the 15th century. And they fought sometimes, but for the most part, they traded. The trading was good for both sides. And when the Ottomans defeated the Byzantines in 1453 and Istanbul turned, Constantinople disappeared and Istanbul was the new name of the city, the Venetians thought that, well, they could more or less continue the relationship on the same basis with the Ottomans. So nothing much would change. There would be disagreements and whatever, and there might even be some military problems, but basically the competition between the two states was economic. The Ottomans had no such idea at all. They saw economic competition with Venice, and they also saw strategic competition with Venice. So they were attacking the Venetians, for example, for 100 years after that, even beyond the Battle of Lepanto, 120-odd years later. And they were continued their march into Europe, into the Balkans, into the coast of North Africa. When the Venetians woke up and figured out what was going on, they were through. So I'm not predicting the same thing for the United States with China by any means, but what I am saying is that in answer to your question, where does this go, I think that a large part of the answer lies with what does the United States do? Do we continue to maintain a naval presence in the Western Pacific in force? Does our policy acknowledge that strategic competition with China is a fact of life? And is that reflected in our budget and the way we allocate our national security resources? Those questions are critical to answering yours. I think most of the answer lies in our own hands. What do we do?
The Chinese are benefiting, as you've indicated, from our current involvement with the jihadist movements around the world as the Chinese develop their own military-industrial complex, for want of a better term. Is there any possibility, as you see it, that the Chinese are somehow complicit with some of these organizations, jihadist organizations?
I, It's possible, but I don't think it would make a great deal of difference one way or the other. As you know, they have their own problems with Muslims, as was demonstrated graphically last year in Xinjiang province with the Uyghurs and the executions that followed. And so they are aware, I mean, they have Muslim minorities, and they are presumably very aware of the dangers of making too big a fuss over this. But I don't think that the jihadists, as long as the Saudis are rolling in money, or other states in the area that have problems with radical fundamentalist Islam and a lot of money, I don't think that the jihadists are having a problem with money. So I don't think they really need China's, and I don't think it would be in China's obvious interest to get too close to these people. I wouldn't worry about that.
And Seth, on that note, brings us to the top of the hour, very quick, 30 minutes. Thank you very much for coming on Midrash and taking some time out this Sunday afternoon to talk with us.
Gentlemen, my pleasure.
Good.
Thank you, Seth.
Right.
I hope you have a good week. We'll talk to you soon. And just as a reminder to everybody, you're listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio Midrats. I'm Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host Eagle One from the blog Eagle Speak. And just incidentally, we're both co-bloggers over at the United States Naval Institute with a good gaggle that they've managed to put together over there. Always recommend go over there and at least visit now and then. Want to move on today to our second guest. Our second guest is Bill Raggio. He is the managing editor of the Long War Journal and the president of Public Multimedia Incorporated. That's a nonprofit media organization with a mission to provide original and accurate reporting and analysis of the Long War. He is also a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a Hoover Institute media fellow, and a contributor to the Weekly Standard. His coverage includes the wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Lebanon, and Iraq, as well as Al-Qaeda's operations, tactics, and strategy in a global sense. He is embedded with the Marine Corps, the Army, the Georgian Army, the Iraqi Army, and also the Iraqi police in Iraq in 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008. And he's also been with the Canadian Army in Afghanistan back in 2006. His articles have been published in the Washington Times, the New York Post, the National Review, the Toronto Times, and a German publication that I won't even try to pronounce, but I think it's Die Welte Woche. His photographs have been published in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. He also presents regularly at the U.S. Air Force's Contemporary Counterinsurgency Warfare School on the media and embedding reporting. Bill, been in uniform as well. He served as a signalman and an infantryman in the U.S. Army and the New Jersey National Guard from 91 to 97. Bill, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, it's great to finally get to talk with you guys on Midrats. I hope everything's well and you're having a great Sunday.
Hey, any Sunday back home is a great Sunday, as I'm sure you can appreciate.
Absolutely.
One thing I wanted to bounce off of you, just to start off in the broad sense, over at the Long War Journal, I know a few years back everybody kind of moved away from the phrase the Long War. Personally, I've always liked the Long War because I thought it was very descriptive of where we have found ourselves for the last decade and probably where we are going forward. When you look at the phrase long war, how do you find it? How do you define it? And where do you see the West's position in the long war? And also the people on the other side of the fence, how do they view the long war?
Yeah, you know, back, I think it was 1 or 2 years ago, when it was last year when the Obama administration mentioned that they, you know, no longer wanted to use the term long war.
Yeah.
I can really consider changing the name of the website to the Overseas Contingency Operations Journal, but I didn't think it was very catchy.
Doesn't roll off the tongue.
So, it just didn't, like you said, just didn't roll off the tongue, so I decided to keep it the Long War Journal. And the term really hasn't gone away. Even those who are critical of it still wind up using the term long war, sometimes derisively, but they recognize, you know, 9 years into this thing that it is indeed a long war. And then the long war really is just another name for the global war on terror. But I think it's more, in a sense, it's more descriptive, because the long war, this is not going to be a war where we go into Afghanistan and defeat and oust the Taliban from power, and we've suddenly defeated Al-Qaeda and its sponsor, the Taliban. This is going to be a multi-generational war against the Islamic extremists of all stripes who are hell-bent on attacking the United States and her allies and have succeeded in Europe, in the United States, of course, with 9/11. We almost had an attack. Several attacks actually been foiled or just flat-out failed. Think Detroit on Christmas or the Times Square bombing several months ago. Had those devices been a little bit better built, we'd be talking about more dead Americans here. The long war it's probably, you know, when everybody, at least they, in the beginning, they made comparisons to World War II, the fight against, you know, Nazi Germany, and perhaps that's apt in the sense of the ideology that we're facing. You know, what I think it's fair to call an evil ideology that is, you know, hell-bent on killing people that they just don't like, that just don't conform to their worldview. But in a sense, the long war is much more comparable in its the way it will be fought and the scope of it to the Cold War. It's, you know, again, we're fighting, you know, an ideology that, you know, that is completely foreign to what we in the United States are used to. And it's an ideology like communism, that crosses a lot of boundaries. You know, the Muslims can be radicalized in countries all across the world, even in the West. As a matter of fact, that's where a good bit of those who want to attack us here in the West are recruited from. They have been for years, and they continue to do so, just as communists, local communists in the United States and in Europe and in Central America and South America and in Africa, South Asia, and you name it. The communists were very effective in recruiting amongst those who were sympathetic to its cause. So I hope did that answer your question?
Good enough as any.
Okay, good. Yeah, and look, I think I'll go with one more. I'll just say that you know, this is as much as a war against ideology as it is, or of competing ideologies. You know, the American narrative, the narrative of freedom and tolerance of others, and then the Islamist narrative, which I don't think I need to go into much detail here. Intolerance for anyone who disagrees with their worldview, the use, you know, just wanton use of violence, suicide bombings, intimidation, terror. These two are going to be competing against each other for years, and unfortunately, the United States, 9 years into this thing, has refused to wage an ideological battle against the Islamists. We've completely ceded on the information operations front. We make no effort because things like information operations are very icky, because we're talking about religion, and the United States government doesn't want to talk about religion because it's afraid to do so. It's afraid to alienate people. This, you know, there isn't a religious component of this war, but I would argue that's more on our side. We don't play up the fact that more Muslims die fighting against Al-Qaeda, against the Taliban. You know, Iraqis die at a rate that we wouldn't here in the United States tolerate on a daily basis, fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Shia terror groups. They did it back in, you know, in 2007, and they continue to do it today.
Yeah, I always thought it was kind of a cognitive disconnect on our part, where just because you don't want to be in a religious war doesn't mean that you're not in one, because if your enemy defines it as such, you're in one. And I also thought that the definition long war worked real well, because you're not fighting big formations in a defined territory with a defined government. You're battling ideas, and just like a lot of very smart people have spent a lot of time trying to define when this war started, I think in hindsight there will be lots of arguments to define when this war ended. In the hard to define the beginning, hard to define the end, there's going to be a big part in the middle. It's going to be very, very difficult to define that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think you're going to have an event like the fall of the Soviet Union to, you know, demark the end of the Cold War. I think it's going to be, you know, when we do if we do finally win, it won't be done. I think it'll be our grandkids or our great-grandkids that might be able to see this. And even then, I'm not certain that they'll even know that we won until historians are able to look back. And, you know, there's just not going to be a Treaty of Versailles or the collapse of the Soviet Union or something to that effect to tell us that this thing is over. Because what you have is you have all of these disparate groups who conduct local insurgencies as well as contribute to the cause and conducting attacks against the West or Western allies. So in the case of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, Al-Qaeda's branch in North Africa, yes, they focus on Algeria and Mali and Mauritania and you name it. We go down the list of countries. However, they fund attacks and try and recruit for attacks in Europe. Same thing with Shabaab here in the United States, and we could go down the list. So, you know, until each of these branches are destroyed, and then Al-Qaeda's leadership is completely destroyed, and people and Muslims don't see, you know, particularly young angry Muslims, because I think you have the same effect that existed with communists. You know, there's that lure of the rebel or it's that sort of that Che Guevara effect, I guess, where it's, you know, rebellious youth and goes and fights the man. That's what you get that a bit with the Muslim recruiting as well, for the recruiting within the Muslim communities for Al-Qaeda. And until that's not seen as being, you know, alluring and sexy anymore, there's going to always be an ample pool of recruits.
Well, but Bill, this is Eagle One. One of the problems you've got, and let's use Pakistan as an example. It's not a religion in the sense that we think of. You go to church on Sunday and maybe on Wednesday night. I mean, the whole concept of Islam is it is a lifestyle. It is a government. Everything you do in your life is governed by the tenets set forth in the Quran and in the other books that have been developed therefrom. And we see in Pakistan over the years that they've gone back and forth between trying to be some sort of representative democracy and going into a fundamentalist Islamic state. With this current flooding, is there another possibility with Pakistan that we're going to see some kind of Islamic revolution come out of that? Where are the Pakistani Taliban? Taliban, is there, as somebody big says, where's all this stuff going now? What are we doing in Pakistan?
Yeah, so Pakistan is perhaps, in my estimation, is the biggest problem that the U.S. faces in the long war. Yet what you have is a state that is dominated by its military and intelligence services. So you may have a democratic government, an elected government, but that elected government is essentially a front for the military, because those who wield the real power in Pakistan is the ISI, Inter Services Intelligence Directorate, and the Pakistani military. The ISI is basically a branch of the military. And what the Pakistani military and the ISI and a lot of Pakistani elites, they support Islamist terror groups, Jamaat-ud-Dawah, Lashkar-e-Taiba. It's the same thing. One's a front for the other. Even elements of the Taliban, there's quote-unquote good Taliban, like the Haqqani Network, Mullah Nazir, Mullah Baradar. Again, we go down the list. And until the Pakistani state itself changes, this is going to be a major problem for the U.S. I mean, this is why, look, it's no secret that the insurgency in Afghanistan grew because of the support that came from Pakistan. It's either by turning a blind eye to what was happening or, in some cases, active support. If the Pakistani government wanted the Afghan Taliban leadership to be in chains, they would be. The ISI keeps tabs on them, or in some cases, some of them spend time in Pakistani safe houses. So as far as, you know, the Taliban were probably in Pakistan were at the height of their power in 2008 and early 2009. So you have some competing things going on here in Pakistan. The movement of the Taliban in Pakistan, which all Taliban in Pakistan are not a part of, they really got emboldened in 2007, 2008, 2009, and started taking over large blocks of territory. and conducted suicide attacks against the Pakistani state, the military, police, whatnot. So this is what the Frankenstein monster got away from the Pakistanis. And it started overtaking large areas in northwestern Pakistan. The Pakistani military has rolled them back, but they still don't see these quote-unquote good Taliban or groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, Jamaat-e-Dawa, the alphabet soup of Pakistani terror groups that are funded and supported by the Pakistani state. So until that changes, there's probably not going to be any real progress in that area of the world. Concerning the floods, I think the Pakistani Taliban, the one, that was attempting to overthrow the Pakistani state, they've been set back by the Pakistani military operations, but they're still around. The reality is that the Pakistani government and the Pakistani military put their full weight in defeating the Taliban. They could, but they won't they want to keep some of that as strategic depth against, a possible U.S. pullout in Afghanistan. That way they have people that they can use to influence the situation there. And it's also strategic depth against India. So, for instance, when Mumbai happened, the terror assault in Mumbai, and there was a possibility of war between India and Pakistan, you had on one hand Pakistani generals coming out and calling the Pakistani Taliban, and I'm talking about the movement of Taliban in Pakistan, called them patriots. And then on the other hand, you had the Pakistani Taliban saying, hey, we'll come, if you need us to fight the Indians, we'll come out and fight for you. So I think that situation alone really illustrates how the Pakistani state and the Taliban view each other. So they may be competing at times or enemies at times. Their common enemy is the U.S., in my opinion, and the Indians. I don't think the floods, at least in the short term, can cause an overthrow of the Pakistani government. I think in the longer term, though, the Pakistani government has been weakened. I still think the military, wields the power here. And, during that Taliban takeover in 2009, the government, the military, was able to roll the Taliban back at some cost to it. But, it wasn't overly difficult for them. They're just not willing to go the full distance and denude and destroy the Pakistani Taliban and the alphabet soup of terror groups.
I think when you look at recent living history, people always have to be careful about saying when it comes to stability of governments, oh, that'll never happen, because a lot of people said that about the way the Soviet Union finally fell apart at the time. And also people said that about how the Khomeini Revolution in Iran did. And it's not within the standard deviation of possibilities that were one wrong general with the right amount of power in Pakistan, you could see a radical government taking power in Pakistan, and that of course gives them control of the Pakistani nuclear arsenal. And independent of anything that may do with India, that really presents the U.S. with one of two choices. Either it defines that as a significant enough threat that even if we had the capability to do it, we would try to secure those nukes, or the more likely event, especially with the present administration, would be to do nothing and hope for the best. But having that type of government that would have the resulting attitude towards the Islamic radicals to their west and in Pashtunistan, combined with holding nukes, how much of a game changer is that in that part of the world, especially when you would deal with the Indians and how they've tried to stay in the background as much as they can to this point?
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting question. And I actually think that we're already there. I would say in some sense, you really do have radical generals running things in Pakistan. I mean, this is a military that has ordered suicide attacks in Afghanistan. They supported the Haqqani network and Lashkar-e-Taiba to carry out suicide attacks against the Indian embassy in Kabul. Elements of the Pakistani military intelligence service provided support for the Mumbai operations, the terror assault there. And then some people say, well, they're just leveraging their their assets that they've built up to conduct attacks against India, and that's just a localized problem. Well, it just doesn't work that way. I mean, you know, these terror networks, Lashkar-e Taiba is close to Al-Qaeda. It's been, my intelligence sources call it Al-Qaeda Jr., that if Al-Qaeda was completely destroyed tomorrow, we woke up and Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri were dead, and all of Al-Qaeda's top leadership was dead, and most of their fighters were killed, Lashkar-e Taiba could step in with its alternate leadership and still create problems for the U.S. And the West and South Asia and in many parts of the world. It has a global network. So one thing I would say is that the Pakistani generals in charge are far more subtle. And I think that's actually far more dangerous, because what you have now is you have top U.S. military leaders and U.S. policymakers who for years have refused to see what is clearly in front of their face. This is my opinion, of course, and that you have a double-dealing Pakistani government and Pakistani institutions that, you know, are looking out at the best interests of the Pakistanis, of themselves, and who really do buy into, in some cases, buy into this radical worldview of the Islamists. So I think that that type of situation is in some ways far more dangerous. Now, the Pakistanis military doesn't want to give up control of its nukes. That's for certain. So that's not such a bad situation in that respect. But those type of things, that could change at any point, any day, if they decided to do it. What would the U.S. do? I think that I'd like to think that the United States government would team up with India and destroy Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. But then you get into a situation where, are you sure you got them all? We believe that we know where they all are, but do the Pakistanis know that we think we got them where they are? So you want to start playing that game? It's, you know, this is why, you know, this, the Pakistan's possession of nuclear weapons raises the problems of any type of outside intervention within Pakistan. It just makes them completely, almost impossible in some sense, because nobody wants to go through, nobody wants to be responsible if some type of intervention happens to kick off a nuclear war. Nobody wants to deal with that type of problem. And so what you have is these nukes, in a sense, become the Islamist nuclear umbrella, because the Pakistani military can support terror attacks against its neighbors and, you know, allow terror attacks to occur in the West with no repercussions. So, you know, it's only a couple of steps away from them potentially getting their hands on nuclear material. And if they don't get, let's say they don't have the ability to get a nuke itself, there's always that knowledge that exists out there. Look at how AQ Khan is said to have, you know, flirted with terrorists, and, you know, there's the proliferation issues with Pakistan. And, you know, in this, you know, to take a step a little further east, this is why we cannot let Iran get nuclear weapons. But unfortunately, no one's going to do anything to stop Iran as well. So, you know, look, if we're not willing to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear power when we could see what's happening or what has happened with Pakistan being nuclear power, then we're not willing to go in and really take care of the problem of Pakistan's nukes.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, some of the questions you've just answered, which is we give the Iraniacs a hard time about the about their nuclear desire, but we have not done much with the Pakistanis. And I don't know if the difference is the maybe you have a thought on it, that Pakistan doesn't quite sit on the same trade routes and choke points like Iran does, and you know, with the valuable oil flow that comes out of the Middle East. But what if you could be king for a day, Bill? What would you do about Pakistan if you were the U.S.?
Not that we have a king,
but.
Yeah, if I was in control of the U.S. policy, for one, I'd fire all of the quote-unquote experts who have recycled all these bad ideas that we've had on Pakistan for the last 9 years. This administration is trying to package the same failed policies that the Bush administration carried out with respect to Pakistan, and they're rebranding them as these new and innovative ideas. And let's face it, it's bribe the Pakistani military and elites and hope and pray that they'll one day take on the Taliban and other groups. And I want
Amen.
A pony, and that's not going to happen either. You know, as a matter of fact, I have a better chance of getting a pony. But if I was king for a day, I would drop the facade of, you know, that we could change the Pakistanis, and I'd team up with India, and I'd arm India to the teeth, and I'd bunker down in Afghanistan, and perhaps consider going in and getting, you know, but unfortunately, these are solutions that nobody are willing to contemplate, so they're not going to happen. I mean, that's why, look, this is why the Pakistani, Pakistanis get away with what they get away with, because nobody in Washington is willing to admit what the real problem is that the Pakistani government and the Pakistani state is a terror-sponsoring state, and nobody wants to really go to war with Pakistan. But I'm sorry, but until that terror state is dismantled, we're going to have the problem of Pakistan.
Yeah, I think the only nation that really sees Pakistan for what they are is the Indians. And they would definitely...
I agree 100%.
They know him better than anybody. You piqued my interest. I wanted to back up for a second. We were talking about Iran, and I agree with you. Nobody's going to do anything about the Iranian efforts to get a nuclear weapon. And I know recently, especially with their latest little cruise missile they showed, a lot of people poo-pooed it. But I don't poo-poo it, because making a nuclear weapon is the height of 1945 technology. If you reach that level, you can make a nuke if you have access to the raw materials. It's simple as that. And the Iranians have mastered 1945 technology with their modern version of the V-1 they flew the other day. But if Iran, or when Iran, does get an operable nuclear weapon, I really don't see who defines themselves as the premier Sunni power, the Saudis, sitting by and letting the premier Shia power, the Persians, have their own nuclear weapon. And so you're going to see the Saudis go nuclear, the Iranians go nuclear, and of course you have it in Pakistan as well. And we will probably just sit by and let that happen with a bunch of talking in between. How does that change our dynamic with dealing in that part of the world, or are we just stuck with what's going to come?
I think we're just stuck what's going to come. And let me just add a couple of things to what you said. The Saudis already have a nuclear program. It's called Pakistan. They've bought and paid for it. It would be a matter of them transferring, getting weapons transferred, and that's what would happen. Also, the Egyptians would go nuclear. That's another great state that we'd love to have nuclear weapons. You have the UAE exploring this as well. You know, you want to see nuclear proliferation explode? Let the Iranians get the bomb, and they're going to get it. And I agree with the point what you made about the technology. If you could build that nuke, and you could build missiles, at some point you could connect a nuke to a missile. I know there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the background, but once you've mastered that technology of building the nuke, it's not a far reach to put that nuke on some type of something that can be delivered. The problem is that, the U.S.'s policy is we can't let Iran get nukes, but we've completely, and this goes for the Bush administration as well, and the current administration, there's just no political will whatsoever to stop Iran from being a nuclear power. So people, whenever I get asked on radio or television, what are we going to do? Are we going to have that invasion? What are we going to do to stop the Iranians? The answer is nothing, because we have a stated policy of not allowing them to develop nukes, but we don't have the big stick behind it. We are not willing to do what it takes to stop the Iranians from getting nukes. And then everyone falls back on, well, the Israeli Air Force can do this. But all I have to say to people is, look at the numbers. How are you going to get you basically need the entire Israeli Air Force to sortie and, to conduct one run of hitting targets. How are you going to fuel them? How are you going to get it back? Just look at the numbers. It's not possible. We can't, if we're going to rely on the Iranians, or I'm sorry, on the Israelis to do this, that's a loser's game as well. If the U.S. doesn't want Iran to be a nuclear power, the reality is the U.S. needs to stop Iran from being a nuclear power, and that requires the U.S. doing things that it's not willing to contemplate doing, conduct airstrikes, potentially occupying territory in Iran. And it's, you know, we've made the use of force something that is so, you know, difficult to do and so difficult to justify, and the legal issues with it, you know, that are involved in this, to be so prohibitive that the Iranians know this and they're playing us like fools.
And Bill, thank you very much for coming on MidRat. Go to Long War Journal, everybody. Thank you very much. Have a great Navy day.
Thanks, Bill. Gentlemen. It was a pleasure.
Leave the strand and Piccadilly for you.